ještě. Shri Rupam Sarvajatam Sadhanam Ravatam Vitam Samsajivam Sarvaitam Sarvajatam Harijana Sai Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Param Sadhanam Ravitam Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya Chapter 7, text 2 to 12. So, I'm just going to read the translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, O King, once upon a time, the King of Heaven, Indra, being extremely proud because of his great opulence of the three worlds, transgressed the law of Vedic etiquette. Seated on his throne, he was surrounded by the Maruts, Vasus, Rudras, Adityas, Ribhus, Vishvadevas, Sadyas, Ashwini Kumaras, Siddhas, Charanas, and Gantharvas, and by great saintly persons. Also surrounding him were the Vijidharas, Apsaras, Kinaras, Hataka birds, and Urugas, snakes. All of them were offering Indra their respects and services, and the Apsaras and Gantharvas were dancing and singing with very sweet musical instruments. Over Indra's head was a white umbrella as effulgent as the full moon. Fanned by yak-tail wisps and served with all the paraphernalia of a king, Indra was sitting with his wife Satyadevi, who occupied half the throne. Okay, somebody tell me what's going on in the scene? Who's around Indra?
Snakes.
Snakes. And? Singers? Kinaras? Vijidharas? Who else? Apsaras. Okay. And who's sharing his throne? Satyadevi. When the great sage Brahaspati appeared in that assembly. And here he comes now. So, you know, Indra was sitting on his throne and all the residents of the higher planets are around him. His beautiful wife is by his side. Everyone's entertaining him, and who walks in? His spiritual master. Brahaspati, the best of sages, was the spiritual master of Indra and all the demigods, and was respected by the demigods and demons alike. So there are personalities, of course, we say that about the six Goswamis, that they were dhira-dhira, that both the ruffians and the gentle persons respected them. So Brahaspati, Narada Muni is also in this category. When he shows up at Kamsa's place, Kamsa also respects him. So he's respected by both the demigods and the demons. Nevertheless, although Indra saw his spiritual master before him, he did not rise from his own seat or offer a seat to his spiritual master, nor did Indra offer him a respectful welcome. Indra did nothing to show him respect. So he should have offered Brihaspati his own throne. When did Krishna do that?
Sudama
offered his own bed. And to whom did he offer his own throne? Narada. When Narada came to visit all the palaces of all of Krishna's kings. Who else did this? Who else was sitting on a big seat and wasn't respectful when somebody came in? This is an easy one. Daksha. Well, Daksha was actually sort of the opposite. with Daksha, yeah, Ramaharshan Sutta. With Ramaharshan Sutta was speaking to the sages at Namasharanya. And who walked in? Lord Balaram. And it said that Ramaharshan Sutta was thinking, well, Balaram's a Kshatriya, and I'm a Brahmana. And I'm on the Vyasa-san, so why should a Brahmana sitting on the Vyasa-san have to offer respects to a Kshatriya? Even though everybody else in the assembly respected him. And then Balaram was thinking, you know, I don't know if you're really a Brahmana. Right? Balaram killed him. With Daksha and Lord Shiva, unless you're thinking of another instance, I'm thinking when Daksha walked into the assembly, Lord Shiva didn't respect him. Why should Shiva have respected him? was a senior elder, was his father-in-law, particularly that he was his father-in-law. So he should have shown him respect. Why didn't he respect him? On the yajna. Well, almost.
Yeah.
Close. Why didn't he show respect to Daksha? He was concentrating on what? In the heart. He was in trance. He was in a state of trance. In a deep trance. He wasn't even aware that Daksha had entered. And of course, Daksha took that as a great offense. Who else was in a state of trance and didn't welcome a guest? Maharaj Parikshit was the guest, and who was in the state of trance? Shamaka Rishi. Oh, I don't know that story. That must be in the Mahabharata or something, that version. Because the way it's described, sometimes the stories are described in different ways in different places, but I'm not familiar with that particular description of it. In the Bhagavatam, it's when Maharaj Parikshit is hunting in the forest, and he gets very hungry and thirsty, and he sees a hut of someone's in there. So he goes in there, and there's Shamaka Rishi in trance, and he says, "Hello. I'm thirsty. Can I have some water? Excuse me?" And Shamaka Rishi doesn't respond at all. So Maharaj Parikshit is offended. And as he's leaving the hut, he sees that right outside the hut, happens to be a dead snake there. So he uses the end of his bow and he picks up the dead snake and he puts it on Shamaka Rishi's neck like a garland. And Sringi, who's Shamaka Rishi's son, is playing a little ways away, and he sees this whole thing take place. And when he sees it, he says, "I curse Maharaj Parikshit to die in 7 days from the bite of a snake bird." And then he rouses his father from trance and tells his father the whole story, at which point his father is very upset. He says, "You shouldn't have cursed the king. He's a good man, you know, he just takes off the dead snake and throws it away, he's not interested." And then later he goes to Maharaj Parikshit and says, "By the way, I think you should know that my son's cursed you, you're going to die in 7 days." So these are different examples of the importance of showing respect to anyone, what to speak of to your spiritual master, what to speak of to a superior. One is supposed to show respect to any guest as if that guest is God. And sometimes God and the demigods show up as guests. Sometimes they disguise themselves as ordinary guests. It happened with Maharaj Rishabhdev. He had been fasting for something like 40 days, and he's about to eat. And these guests come one after another, and he gives them his food. He even gives them his water. Then they reveal themselves as the devas. So any guest is supposed to be received very nicely, at least with what? Some water, a sitting place, and sweet words. Even if that guest is your enemy. Even if the guest is your enemy, a guest comes, at least offer them water and a sitting place and sweet words. At least. At least. What to speak if that guest is your superior, that guest is your father, or the guest is your father-in-law, or the guest is someone superior to you by caste, or what to speak of if that guest is your spiritual master. And Indra didn't even say hello. He didn't even say, "Oh, namaste, Brihaspati." Nothing. He didn't acknowledge him, but it says he saw him. So in the example of Lord Shiva or Shamaka Rishi, they didn't see. Lord Shiva was actually not aware of Daksha's presence. Shamaka Rishi was not aware of Maharaj Parikshit's presence. But Indra was aware that Brihaspati had entered, and he willfully ignored him. He willfully ignored him. Brihaspati knew everything that would happen in the future. Seeing Indra's transgression of etiquette, he completely understood that Indra was puffed up by his material opulence. Although able to curse Indra, he did not do so. Instead, he left the assembly and in silence returned to his home. So I'm pretty sure it's in the story of King Riga. You know where King Riga gives a cow to one Brahmin and it wanders back, and then he accidentally gives the same cow to another Brahmin and the Brahmins become angry with him. I'm pretty sure it's in that context. It might be in another place. where Prabhupada says that Krishna doesn't have to get involved if Brahmins get angry. If a Brahmin gets angry, that's sufficient. But if a Brahmin is just sorry, then Krishna will take action. So in this case, Brahmaspati does not get angry. He does not curse Indra. He just thinks, all right, I know where this is going to go. He could see into the future. Sri Mada Vikriya, deterioration because of madness. Sri is opulence and Mada is madness. He's become mad due to opulence, and he thought, he's not headed for a very good place. I'm leaving. But he didn't feel it necessary to curse him. He didn't feel personally offended. And we were talking yesterday about when you've offended, when we've offended somebody, and this is about being offended. This is about offending and being offended. So Brahaspati didn't feel personally offended. He wasn't angry. He didn't, He just thought, okay. I'm not going to associate with this anyway. Now this relates a little bit to the question you asked yesterday. Indra, the king of heaven, could immediately understand his mistake. So as soon as Brahaspati turned around and left, right? Has that ever happened? You're doing something and all of a sudden you think, whoops. I just offended somebody. That's not good. Immediately, realizing he had disrespected his spiritual master, he condemned himself in the presence of all the members of the assembly. Now, this is important. You notice that he makes a public apology. He publicly condemns himself. Recently, I had some correspondence with one devotee who... how shall we put this, committed some major indiscretions. Yeah. And this person is in a position of leadership. And although there's a decent amount of evidence that this person has actually done these things that this person should not have done, this devotee is not willing to make any kind of public admission of guilt. And one of the things this devotee kept saying over and over and over to me, and I didn't remember this section of the Bhagavatam, was what precedent is there for a public apology? He kept saying, where do we have in our tradition that anyone has to make a public apology? This person said, well, if I've offended someone personally, I can apologize to them personally, but why should I make a public statement? Now, the person had a good point. He said, if I make a public statement, then people will criticize me even more. So that's probably true, because here we are, how many millions of years later, still criticizing poor Indra. Poor guy. And this is probably one of the reasons why we're hesitant to make public statements of authority, of apology. You ever have that experience? That you admit something wrong and then people use that for the next 10,000 years? You go to someone and say, yeah, you know, I was really wrong. I was just acting out of envy. Or you really admit something from the heart. And then any time after that, person will say, yes, you even admitted that you're envious. I remember what to speak if you put it in writing. And here we are, you know, we're reading the story probably thinking, yeah, that Indra, really fallen guy. But so why was he apologizing in front of everybody? Why didn't he was going to try to apologize to Brahaspati and be unsuccessful at it, but why was he apologizing to everybody, do you think? It was an offense against everybody. Okay. Why? Why was it an offense against everybody? Somebody could say it was only an offense against his guru.
He's showing the wrong example. He's breaking the etiquette.
He's what?
He's showing the wrong example. He's breaking the etiquette.
Okay, as an example. Because he's a role model. So if you're the role model and you break etiquette, then you're doing violence to everybody. Because everybody will follow your example. It's necessary then to say, oh, I did something wrong. You see, there's different responses to this sort of thing by people in positions of authority. And I remember taking a teaching course that was taught, it was a team-taught course. So we had one teacher taught one-third of the course, another teacher taught the other two-thirds of the course. The teacher who taught a third of the course was very quick to admit if he didn't know something. He was also very quick to admit if he presented something wrong. You know, immediately, if you'd say to him, "My dear sir, you said this and this," that wasn't what I meant to say. And the other teacher was exactly the opposite. If he said something foolish and we caught him on it, he would try to find any way to hedge so as to show that actually he hadn't done anything foolish, and it made it very unpalatable. It was very hard to learn from him. So this is something that's very important. I remember one devotee was no longer living in this planet anymore, but who worked a lot with me in education, said that one of the main reasons that our teenagers and young adults leave the movement is because of hypocrisy. So if you're in a position of guiding people, that may be very scary because, okay, how many of you here can say that you always live up to your ideals every single moment of every single day? Boy, lots of us, huh? So if hypocrisy simply means that I sometimes fall down from my ideals, that I sometimes behave in a way that's different from what I believe to be right, then we're all in a lot of trouble. But if that does happen to us, what do we need to do? What's Indra doing here immediately? He's admitting it. He's admitting to all of his subordinates. Now, I'm sure that's a little embarrassing if you're the king of heaven, to admit to all of your subordinates, even the birds and the snakes and the apsaras, right? I just did something abominable. But that's necessary. That's necessary for proper instruction. And don't you find that you have more respect for a leader who does something like that? Okay, so he condemned himself in the presence of all the members of the assembly. Alas! Oh. What a regrettable deed I have committed because of my lack of intelligence and my pride in my material opulences. I failed to show respect to my spiritual master when he entered this assembly, and thus I have insulted him. So this verse is very interesting and instructive for us when we do something wrong. So when somebody wrongs me, and this also may relate to what we were discussing yesterday about how sometimes when we ask for forgiveness, the person we've offended doesn't accept our asking for forgiveness. You know, little children, when they do something wrong, the parents say, "Now say you're sorry," and the child will often go, "Sorry." And many times the parents will say, "Oh, good enough." Often that's the best you'll get. And we learn when we're young that if we say, "Sorry," we can usually go back and play or come back to dinner or whatever. And this tends to persist as we're adults. You know, we've read all these things about offending Vaishnavas. We heard Sri Prahlad's class yesterday about that one offense that, you know, the holy name isn't going to tolerate. And we'll have to stay in this world for hundreds of lives. And, oh, so we offend somebody and we say, "Sorry." Who are we thinking about when we apologize like that? Ourselves. This is the mood of the criminal who doesn't care that they're committing a crime, they just don't want to get caught. So sorry means I don't want to suffer either reaction. I'm thinking about myself and I don't want to suffer a reaction. So here Indra is showing a way of how to offer a genuine apology. And of course, we don't know what his mood was, but it seems his mood was genuinely repentant. Which we were talking about yesterday, about being forgiving. And the same thing, asking for forgiveness. Asking for forgiveness, one has to really know what are the thinking, feeling, willing. What behaviors do I do? We're going to see Indra's behavior. He goes to seek out his guru. He doesn't just make a public apology and then sit there and think, well, if he wants to talk to me, he can come back. So he goes, looks for the person, he apologizes to anybody he's offended, not necessarily just that one person. And now let's see how he apologizes. He says, "What a regrettable deed I have committed because of my lack of intelligence and my pride in my material opulences." So he really looks at what is his own fault in his heart. Vidyantasa Abhadrani. He's trying to find the Abhadras in his heart. What did I do wrong? Then he talks about the specific behavior he did. So he talks about what was wrong with his motive. Then I failed to show respect to my spiritual master. What specifically did I do wrong? And thus I have insulted him. What's he doing there? He's talking about what? How it affected the other person. And our apologies will be taken as sincere or insincere, dependent on whether or not we have these kind of factors. If we honestly say our motivation, if we talk about what specifically we did wrong. You ever find that someone apologizes to you and you're thinking, well, do you really know what you did wrong? He's saying, I did this specific thing wrong, and it was wrong because it caused this particular kind of pain to my guru. My guru felt insulted. Now, something that's very interesting is that, according to modern psychology, often as soon as the person who's offended you identifies how you felt, immediately you feel forgiving. It's a very interesting phenomenon. If I just say to you, when I fail to show respect to my spiritual master, if I say, when I came half an hour late, when I forgot that I was supposed to be there, when I said X, Y, Z, I guess you must have felt hurt, or I guess you must have felt frustrated, or I guess you must have felt angry, or I guess you must have felt distressed. If I can identify your feelings, often then you say, oh yeah, okay, it's all right. So this is one model that Indra is showing us. So that's an actual apology. Now, in order to give this kind of an apology, one has to be vulnerable. It's scary to give this kind of an apology. It's very easy to say, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. But to look within and say, well, let's see, I acted this way because of my, here he says, his lack of intelligence and his pride. I acted this way because of my envy. I acted this way because of my pride. I did this and this and this specific action, and I'm thinking that this is how you felt because of what I did. To do that requires a lot of honesty and a lot of vulnerability. And you see this, of course, is modeled in the animal kingdom. If one animal offends another, like if a wolf offends another wolf, you know what they'll do? To say they're sorry? They roll on their back. When they roll on their back, they can't attack anymore. They're helpless. So if the wolf wants to attack them, they can't. They take a position of surrender. So this is what Indra's doing. He's saying, you know, this is how I'm a guilty party. So the next verse we're going to read responsibly here was, it's all about Americans. So I was wondering if I was going to speak on this one or the next one. How many verses should we pull up? We were doing yesterday. I thought, I wonder if Krishna's going to give me the verse all about Americans. Ko grijet pandito lakshmin jupistapa pater api yayam asuram bhavam nito dhyam bhubureshwara. What do you think asuram bhavam means? A demoniac nature. Ko grijet pandito lakshmin jupistapa pater api yaya hamasuram bhavam nito ja vibhureshwaraha. accept. Panditaha, a learned man. Lakshmin, opulences. So what does the first line mean? Who would accept?
A wealthy scholar.
Who would accept a wealthy scholar? Okay, that's a good guess. Any other ideas?
What scholar
would accept opulences? Yes. What learned man would accept opulences? Tripistapa pati epi. Although I am the king of the demigods, yaya, by which, aham, I, asuram, demoniac, bhavam, mentality, nittaha, carried to, adya, now, vibhuta, of the demigods who are on the mode of goodness, ishvaraha, the king. Translation. Although I am the king of the demigods who are situated in the mode of goodness, I was proud of a little opulence and polluted by false ego. Under the circumstances, who in this world would accept such riches at the risk of falling down? Alas, I condemn my wealth and opulence. So, we're looking here at how to be steady. Indra's problem here is the problem that any of us have in this world. Indra is generally in goodness, as it says here, the Buddha. Generally is in goodness. But he became bewildered by his opulences. So do we have this sometimes? Again, we're talking about sticking to our ideals. So I think especially all of us sitting here in this room, we have some pretty high ideals, don't we? Of what kind of person we want to be. We read the descriptions of the devotee, the 26 qualities of a devotee, the descriptions given in Bhagavad Gita. Where are the descriptions in Bhagavad Gita of the qualities of the devotee? My Bhagavad Gita, my Wednesday Bhagavad Gita group. Where in Bhagavad Gita are there descriptions of the qualities of a devotee?
Heaps of places.
Great answer. Could you name one of them? Chapter 10, yes. Other places. Chapter 12, end of chapter 12. 16, the divine and demoniac nature.
13.
Oh, that whole list of the process of knowledge. Okay. 8 to 12, 13, 8 to 12. Also, end of chapter 14 and end of chapter 2. Heaps! And there's probably lots of little verses scattered hither and thither, right? Like Satatam Kirtayam Dhamma. So we read these verses and we're thinking, yes, this is what I want. These are the qualities that I want. Pretty high, isn't it? I don't know, when you first come to Krishna consciousness, there's a tendency you read those and you think, yeah, I got most of them. The longer that you chant Hare Krishna, the fewer, somehow it's a backwards process. The longer you stay in the process, the fewer those qualities it seems like you have. But anyway, we're aspiring to have all these very exalted qualities, but we find that, well, we don't always live up to our ideals. Not like I asked you, who here 24/7 lives up to their ideals? And here Indra's saying, I'm supposed to be in the mode of goodness, but who did he act like? Who did he say he acted like? A demon. He said, I had the bhava. I said, I had the mentality of a demon. By the way, his ability to see that he had the mentality of a demon is the result of the mode of goodness. If people are very much in the mode of ignorance and passion, what they'll say is, well, sometimes I don't act right, but my motives are all good. That's generally the mood of materialistic people. And someone who's more advanced will say, well, sometimes, sometimes I may act right, but really my motives are all messed up. So materialistic people said, sometimes I make a mistake, but I have good motives. And the more advanced people said, I may get it right sometime, but my heart is not clean. So here Indra's, he's really taking responsibility for his offense. He's not just saying, well, I was sort of inattentive and distracted, and that's understandable with all these entertainers around, and I would have respected him in 5 minutes. I was just waiting for a minute to show him respect. He didn't say any of that. He took full responsibility. He said, I had the bhava, I had the mood of a demon. Okay, Prabhupada's purport. This is a long purport. He's going to talk about America, and he's also going to say that something is a law of material nature, which I found very disturbing when I read it. I had to read this purport over and over and over again. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu prayed to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What prayer do you think Prabhupada's going to quote? Could be Trinadapi. But this is, of course, in relationship to Lakshmi. Nadanam nadanam nasandarim kavitam bhava jagadish kamayam. O my Lord, I do not aspire for material opulence or wealth, nor do I want a great number of followers to accept me as their leader, nor do I want a very beautiful wife to please me. Mama janmani janmani shre bhavatad bhaktir vartaki twaya. I do not even want liberation. All I want, life after life, is to be a faithful servant of your lordship. According to the laws of nature, when one is extremely opulent, one becomes degraded, and this is true both individually and collectively. So I found that sentence very disturbing. Why do you think I found that sentence disturbing? According to the laws of nature, when one is extremely opulent, one becomes degraded. And this is true both individually and collectively. What do we generally hope for in this world? We generally hope that we'll have two things. Opulence and good qualities. Prabhupada is saying it's a law of nature that if you have extreme opulence, it will degrade you. Do any of us believe that? You believe that? Yeah. But, I mean, as far as ourselves goes, I mean, just think about it. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but really think about this. Do any of us believe that if we got $10 billion, it would degrade us? Do we believe that? No. We believe that I can have all material opulence and I'll still be just the same person. Or better, maybe. Right? Here Prabhupada is saying it's a law of nature that if you have extreme material opulence, either an individual or a group of people will become degraded. It's a pretty heavy statement. I mean, modern society is trying to say, no, no, you can increase, and that's what Prabhupada's about to talk about. That you can increase your material opulence on and on and on and on and on, and you won't become divine. The demigods are situated in the mode of goodness. So some may say, well, what about if I'm in the mode of goodness? Then I won't be degraded by opulence. That's only for the low-class people. So the demigods are situated in the mode of goodness, but sometimes even one who is situated in such an exalted position as King Indra, the king of all the demigods, falls down because of material opulence. Now, Indra is very, very exalted in consciousness. He's not some ordinary person. So now he's giving an example, collectively. We are now actually seeing this in America. The entire American nation has tried to advance the material opulence without striving to produce ideal human beings. The result is that Americans are now regretting the wholesale criminality of American society and are wondering how America has become so lawless and unmanageable. I was wondering if Prabhupada wrote this purport. There was a time when he went to Chicago. It was in 1975. And on the airplane, he was looking at a magazine, it was Time magazine, called Crime, Why and What to Do. And when he arrived in Chicago, he spoke with a police officer about how Krishna consciousness could combat crime. So I was wondering if Prabhupada wrote this purport at that time. I'm sure we could figure that out. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 7531, Nate vidu swartha gatim hi Vishnu. Who says that first? Sri Prahlad. Not Sri Prahlad Das, although he may say that first sometimes too. Persons who are unenlightened do not know the aim of life, which is to return home back to Godhead. Therefore, both individually and collectively, they try to enjoy so-called material comforts. So the reason one tries for material opulence is you don't know the aim of life. That David is for Dikatimi Vishnu. And Prabhupada says so-called material comforts. And they become addicted to wine and women. The men produced in such a society are less than fourth class. They are the unwanted population known as Varnasankara. And as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, an increase of Varnasankara population creates a hellish society. This is a society in which Americans now find themselves. The Varnasankara literally means you can't tell the person's Varna. In Vedic times, it generally referred to illegitimate children, children where you couldn't tell who their parents were, they didn't have any proper upbringing. According to sociologists, as soon as you get 25% of a population that are born out of marriage, your population starts to degrade. And I don't know what the statistics are for New Zealand, but in America, it is now 40% of children are born out of marriage. 40%. And a lot of those are deliberate, which is what's really amazing. What's happening is that people are no longer marrying young. They're delaying marriage, delaying marriage, delaying marriage, delaying marriage. And so you have women who get to be 40 years old, they're not married, or they were married and divorced, and they never had a child, and they want to have a child. So they intentionally have a child as a single parent. So that's a lot of the cause of the increase. Another cause of the increase, of course, is the taking away the social stigma on illegitimate children. With good intentions. Why should you have the innocent child suffer from the indiscretions of the parents? But because of taking away the social stigma from the child, you then open the door for men to be irresponsible. Well, why do I have to hang around and take care of this woman and this child that I fathered? Because, you know, big deal. She can just get money from the government and she won't be judged harshly, you know. I'm tired of her now. She was pretty when she was 20 and now she's not so pretty anymore at 35. And she's asking for a bigger house. I think I'll get out the door. And then the women are more likely to engage in irresponsible behavior because they think, well, you know, there won't be so much of a backlash from the society and I'll get maintained. So this policy that was originally designed just to be compassionate has ended up creating a whole society of Varnasankara, unwanted children, children who are not properly cared for, and children who don't know their position in society, lower than the fourth class person. Fortunately, however, the Hare Krishna movement has come to America, and many fortunate young men are giving serious attention to this movement, probably uses the word fortunately twice in that sentence, which is creating ideal men of first-class character, men who completely refrain from meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. If the American people are serious about curbing the degraded criminal life of their nation, now Prabhupada's going to do two things they have to do. They must take to the Krishna consciousness movement and try to elevate the kind of human society, try to create the kind of human society advised in Bhagavad Gita, Chaitra Vanya Maya Shristam Guna Karma Vibhaga Shaha. They must divide their society into first-class men, second-class men, third-class men, fourth-class men. Since they are now creating only men who are less than fourth-class, how can they avoid the dangers of a criminal society? So what are the two things that Prabhupada says has to be done? Krishna consciousness and Varnashram. We can consider why. Long, long ago, Lord Indra regretted his disrespect to his spiritual master, Brahaspati. Similarly, it is advised that the American people regret their mistaken advancement in civilization. They should take advice from the spiritual master, the representative of Krishna. If they do so, they will be happy, and theirs will be an ideal nation to lead the entire world. So Prabhupada also was talking about the importance of regret. As an individual, when we do something wrong, or as a society, when we do something wrong, there should be some regret. So first I want to ask, why would material opulence cause degradation even for someone who's in the mode of goodness? Why is Prabhupada saying it's a law? I mean, basically, if you're conditioned soul, you don't believe that law. You think, I can enjoy the material world without becoming degraded. I can touch fire and not get burned. I can engage in sense gratification and not have a reaction. That's the whole mentality of conditioned soul. So Why is it that as soon as there's extreme opulence, or this is extremely opulent, why would one become degraded?
Well, there's not 100% in goodness.
Yes, because material goodness is not pure. This is explained very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter, that someone in goodness tends to become what? Proud. And pride is a symptom of passion. So when you're in the material goodness, you tend to become satisfied and think, I'm okay, I'm a good person. I was just reading this wonderful essay of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, how he said that when he first met his spiritual master, that he had this sense of pride in being a good person and being a pious person. And he also had this sense of a very knowledgeable person, Hare Krishna. And he said that his guru, Gaurakishore Das Babaji, just didn't give any notice to that. Didn't take it as anything significant. So if a person's very pious, they tend to become proud of it. I'm honest, I pay my taxes, I don't speak lies. I do this, I do that, I'm a good person. And this pride can lead to fall down. So even if you're in the mode of goodness, what happens, do you think, a person in the mode of goodness who has a lot of material opulences is thinking, I'm handling this really well. I'm able to use all these opulences really well without becoming degraded. And probably said we're not afraid enough of Maya. Whereas we find the devotee, I'm just reading Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instructions to Sanatana Goswami, and he's talking about the symptoms of one in bhava. Here Indra's talking about the asaram bhava. But if one has love for Krishna, one is always dependent on Krishna's mercy. One feels oneself very humble, very small. I'm just a little, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was saying, sthita duli, I'm a little grain of dust. And we're at once asking for Krishna's protection always. One's taking shelter of Krishna. One's thinking, Krishna's going to maintain me. We find this Lord Brahma, when he's creating, he says to Krishna, Krishna, I'm going to be creating. Please give me protection from pride. So don't let me fall down due to thinking that I'm a controller. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu embraces the leper, Vasudeva, then Vasudeva says to him, please, Lord, how will I not become proud that you have healed me in this way? Please give me humility. So that's the mood of the devotee. They're afraid of material opulence because they're afraid that it will cause them to become proud and forget that they're dependent on Krishna. And if one's not fully dependent on Krishna, then the law of material nature is such that one will become proud. One will start thinking, I'm very intelligent, I'm very beautiful, I'm very rich, or even I'm very renounced. Now the devotee who's dependent on Krishna can use great material opulence without becoming degraded. And we find Maharaj Yudhisthira, Maharaj Ambarish, Sudama Brahmana, and there's so many examples of devotees who were able to use great opulence without becoming degraded. But their mood was always one of humility and always one of dependence. Just the mode of goodness isn't sufficient. You know, when we take up Krishna consciousness, we're generally, most of us, now maybe some of us here were in the mode of goodness when we took up Krishna consciousness, but most of us when we started this process of Krishna consciousness were very much affected by the modes of passion and ignorance. Right? Some people here are more fortunate, some people who were born in the Hare Krishna movement or born in a very pious Indian family where they were worshipping Krishna since childhood. But generally it takes us some time before these modes of passion and ignorance are eradicated. Right? What is it? Satam prasango mama virya samamido bhavanti vidkarna rasayanam katata jyoshina rasva pavarulavartvani shararatir bhakti yanyukramishnati. Gradually, as we're hearing the talks of Vasudeva, then gradually we start progressing on the path of bhakti and the lower modes are eradicated. And we finally come to a platform where we're pretty much in goodness. That's nista, that's fixed. But even at the platform of nista, we're still subjected to some extent to the modes of passion and ignorance. That's not, although it's called nista, although it's called fixed, there's still danger. There's still danger. Basically, Prabhupada says at the stage of bhava, there's no fall down. Because even at nista, you still have some of this asura bhava. You still have some of this demoniac nature. So we shouldn't be satisfied just with coming to goodness. I was once invited to be a facilitator / mediator / teacher among a group of schools in the Hare Krishna movement that were fighting with each other. They were in the same community and they'd been fighting with each other for years. They were stealing each other's students, they were stealing each other's teachers, they were criticizing each other. It was really a mess. So they asked me to come. In fact, they flew me from a long distance to come for just 5 days and try to heal things. So I made a rule and I said, well, no one's going to talk about the past. No one's allowed to talk about the past. And every time there was a break, at least one person, sometimes three, would come up to me and say, when do we get to talk about the past? So I got so disgusted with that that it was going on every day for 5 days. Every single break, at least one person was saying that to me. So finally, on the last day of the meetings, I got up and I said, this desire to rehash, this person did this, and this person said that, and this person did this, and this person said that, and I'm offended by this, and I'm offended by that, and you offended this. And I said, this is demoniac. And I was reading from the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I said, this is the mood of the demons. Please, let's forget it and go on. And after that, one of the leaders came up to me and said, you know, I don't think that anyone here had a mood of a demon. So it's possible, even for Indra, who's in the mode of goodness, to sometimes take on the quality of a demon. And practically, whenever we behave in madness or in lust or in anger, we're taking on the mood of a demon. And the only reason we don't want to admit that is because of our pride, which is the whole problem in the first place. So to become fully fixed, one must become fully fixed at Krishna's lotus feet. Only then is everything going to be eradicated. Yajna supersedity. Only then will we be fully satisfied and have no inclination anymore to go into this demoniac mentality. Until we get to that point, where our mood, our bhava, is one that I just want to make Krishna happy. Then we're going to have these times when we disappoint ourselves. It is disappointing, isn't it? You make this resolution, I'm going to be like this, I'm going to be like this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and then something happens and you blow it. Isn't it disappointing, discouraging? So don't be satisfied with just the mode of goodness. I mean, even the mode of goodness is pretty good for people like me. But don't be satisfied with the mode of goodness. Really change the mentality. We are what we think. I mean, throughout the Shastra, the emphasis is on consciousness, consciousness. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think? All right, so Prabhupada's saying that will solve the problem. And he's saying that will solve the problem not only for an individual, but also for society. But he's also saying we should do something else. What else did he say we should do? Besides come to Krishna consciousness? Varnashrama. Interesting. Why did he say that? Because it's for everybody. I mean, when you come to pure Krishna consciousness, you can then have opulence without being degraded. Of course, when you come to pure Krishna consciousness, you don't really care if you have opulence or not. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was explaining, Rupa Goswami also says this in Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu, that to be qualified for pure devotional service, one should not be either too attached or too detached. Remember saying how Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur commented that Sudama Brahmana received all that opulence because he was too detached. He was proud of being a renunciate. So not too attached, not wanting to enjoy the world, and not too detached, just thinking, oh, the world's false, world's false, world's false. It's all nonsense, it's all nonsense. If Krishna says to any of us, here, take this opulence, rather its wealth, strength, fame, beauty, knowledge, renunciation. Take this opulence and use it in my service. We can't say, no, Lord. Of course, sometimes the devotees do say that. Kolavitra Sridhar said that. And Chaitanya Prabhu was displaying his opulences of Vishnu. He was giving benedictions and he called for Sridhar, the banana leaf cup seller. So banana leaf cups and squash. Squash means like pumpkin, doesn't mean a drink. I was in London once and I said, would you like some squash? And they meant some kind of soda. Anyway, he sold these gourds and also banana leaf cups. So he wasn't a very wealthy person. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu invited him. He said, I'll give you everything. I'll give you planets, 8 mystic powers, followers. He said, I don't want any of that. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu kept pushing. He said, I don't want it. He said, what do you want? He said, life after life, I want to be a seller of banana leaf pots and gourds and have young Nimai come and steal my goods and harass me over the price. So sometimes the devotees actually just refuse. Right? But sometimes if the Lord says, look, I want you to take this and use it in my service, maybe they'll accept. Either way. The devotee doesn't care because that's not the source of his happiness, as Prabhupada says here. It's only because people don't know, not Devadu Swarkati Katimbi Vishnu. It's only because they don't know the goal is Vishnu that they think that their pleasure is going to be found in material objects. The real thing one has to detach from is the idea that things in the material world are going to make me happy. Not the things. It doesn't matter if you give away all your things and wander around naked like a Jain. That's not the point. The point is this thinking that, you know, this house, this car, my spouse, my child, my sari, my whatever, is going to make me happy. It's the source of my happiness. It's my reservoir of pleasure. One has to think Krishna is the reservoir of pleasure. So anyway, for the devotees who've attained the bhava of loving Krishna, they will not fall down to material opulence, and they don't care if they have it or not. They can have it, they can not. Preferably, their own personal preference is not to have them. But if Krishna wants them. But not everybody is immediately going to be on that platform. Even in the Hare Krishna movement, it's not that you walk on the door and say one Hare Krishna, there you are at prema. Of course, Prabhupada does say, he does say, that if you fully surrender to Krishna, Krishna will immediately be present. But for most of us, that surrender to Krishna is a gradual process. So the purpose of Varnashram is to assist that gradual process. We'll just very, very briefly look at it in relationship to material opulence. The brahmanas in Varnashram intentionally stay away from material opulence, although occasionally there are rich brahmanas. The Prabhupada says the only grahastha who's allowed to accept charity is the brahmana, and on the there's a restriction that if a brahmana grahastha lives on charity, they can only take what they need for that day and they have to immediately give away the rest. Otherwise, a brahmana grahastha has to maintain themselves through study, through teaching. But if they're just living on alms, that's the rule. They can't keep anything. They take just the food they need. There's extra rice, extra zucchini, they give it away. Extra clothes, they give it away. Extra gold, they give it away. Extra clothes, they give it away. That day. So they remain in a poverty-stricken condition. And the brahmacharis, vanaprastas, and sannyasis are not supposed to accumulate any material opulence. So who's accumulating material opulence? The grahastas, who are kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. And especially the kshatriyas and the vaishyas accumulate a lot of opulence. Shudras have a hard time accumulating opulence. They also tend to be poor, be rich one day and poor the next. Now that's not because they're giving a charity, though. We do book distribution, and you at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, there were a lot of military persons. So if you got them on a Friday, they had a lot of money, and if you got them on a Monday, they were broke. Right? They'd spend it all on, anyway, what they would spend it all on. And it would all be gone. They'd buy a little whatever. So mostly the kshatriyas and the vaishyas. The kshatriyas are in the mode of passion. And the vaishyas are a mixed passion and ignorance. Now, passion means, I find that devotees often misunderstand passion. Passion means somebody who's very pious. Their motive for piety is honor and fame, but they're very pious. They're following the Shastra. They're trying to live a righteous life. But they're very interested in material opulence. The Kshatriyas were interested in honor, and the Vaishyas were interested in the opulence. So those people are allowed in the society to amass opulence. In fact, those people are required to amass opulence. Why? What are they supposed to then do with that opulence? Distribute it. So the Kshatriya is supposed to be distributing opulence for the benefit of the whole society. And the Vaishyas also, it's the Vaishyas and the Vaishya and Kshatriya Grihasthas who are maintaining the Brahmacharis, the Vanaprasthas, and the Sannyasis, and who are maintaining the Brahmana Grihasthas. So they're allowed to accumulate opulence. In fact, they're supposed to. That's their duty, to accumulate opulence. But they're supposed to do that as a form of giving, not as a form of personal enjoyment, so that they can understand this Isivasya verse of the Isha Upanishad. It actually belongs to Krishna. And they're being guided by the Brahmanas. And that was Indra's problem here. Indra is the main Kshatriya of heaven, and he neglected the guidance of the Brahmanas. And they're being guided by Brahmanas, and they're being guided by people who are in the renounced order, who do not have opulence, who cannot be bought by opulence. As soon as the Brahmanas, Vanaprastha, Sannyasis, Brahmacharis can be bought by the opulence of the wealthy Grihasthas, everything is finished. As soon as you've got hired priests, finished. You lose your honesty. So the people who are renounced and purposely keep themselves renounced, they don't allow themselves to be purchased by opulence. They're guiding the society. And therefore, that opulence doesn't degrade the society, even though not everybody is on the platform of pure devotional service. And in that way, you can have an opulent society without degradation. The Prabhupada says here, if you have an opulent society and no one's even a Shudra, a Shudra means somebody who's obedient, who's respectful, who's honest, then material opulence will cause further and further and further and further degradation. So if we want to be actually an ideal person, we must become a pure devotee of the Lord. We must change our love. We must change our consciousness. We must change our mentality. It's not just external rituals, and it's not just being a nice person. It's changing the world. And for society in general, we need to be the people in society. We need to be the Brahmins in society who can lead the rest. That means we have to be real Brahmanas. Otherwise, there's no hope for the world. It's spiraling down. And of course, if you have opulence and you misuse it, what will happen to your opulence? You lose it. So thank you very much. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements? Not just different jobs in the same occupation, but going from one occupation to another. And you know, if you're Varna Sankara, if you don't know what your tendencies are and what your occupation is, you also can't live a life according to the Shastra. You can't follow. We were talking about last time how each ashram has its enjoyments and its responsibilities, its sacrifices, and that each of those are two sides of the same thing. You know, if you're a grihastha, you get to enjoy your home, but then you got to pay for it, kind of thing. And it's the same with each of the varnas. The varnas particularly apply to the grihasthas, because it's the grihasthas. They talk about how you earn your livelihood. But they also give you guidance for how you should live. And yeah, if you don't know that, you don't know what to do. And you end up just saying, well, I'll take a little bit from here, and a little bit from there, and a little bit from there, and it becomes havoc. And one can't advance even materially. The Prabhupada says that one place, that we're mixed castes of unknown origins. It's a real problem. Yes? In one of those categories.
Yeah.
At best. Is. But it is interesting that although what you're saying is absolutely true, at the same time Prabhupada is suggesting we do both. And it's also interesting because there are many places where Prabhupada says that instituting varnashram is impossible now. And yet he says we should do it. So what do we make of that?
He said that's the purpose of the Hare Krishna movement, is to establish Sankirtan and Vanashram Dhamma.
To establish both Sankirtan and Vanashram Dhamma. I would imagine that it's going to take some time. But it seems difficult because the society outside of the Vaishnavas is going further and further and further away from Vanashram Dhamma. I mean, if we're thinking we're going to gradually institute it, as I said, I mean, when I was growing up, the illegitimacy rate in America was 5%. I knew one divorced family. One. So since I was a little girl until now, the illegitimacy rate has gone from 5% to 40%. So things are getting worse. Things are becoming more disordered. I think it's in the section with Lord Ramachandra Rules the World, where Prabhupada says that if we go on Harinam Sankirtan, we'll create Brahmas and Kshatriyas. Pretty sure it's a purport in that section. And how exactly that works, I'm not sure. And at least one of the leaders of ISKCON has told me several times that he doesn't believe that we'll ever create Kshatriyas. Actual Vedic Kshatriyas, and it's just not appropriate. I don't know, there are certainly still people on the planet in every society who are inclined towards Brahminical work, or who are inclined towards Kshatriya work, or inclined towards Vaishya work, or inclined towards Shudra work. I mean, that is definitely true, isn't it? I mean, there are military people. That's their mood. People who want to be rulers. Or one occupation, etc., as a landlord. I mean, there are people who want to be mayors and governors and presidents and generals and navy lieutenants. And there are people who want to engage in business and farming. And there are people who want to be scholars and teachers and priests. And then there are people who want to be... I mean, that's in a very general way. That is true. I don't know what the steps are to get from here to there. So I probably said to just distribute Krishna consciousness. It doesn't seem to be taking us there in the way that I can perceive. Yeah?
I heard towards the end of Prabhupada's, in his pastimes, Prabhupada mentioned that 50% of his work had not been
done because he hadn't established one ashram.
Yeah, and then came up with Shiva. So I asked him, what's the right scene? He said, an ashram. And then I think he asked him, ask Prabhupada, well, how would you establish it? And Prabhupada said, I would go to what's the name of that farm in America? Anyway, he said, he would go to a particular Iskcon farm and live simply on the land. Like that. He would even show the devotees how to live simply on the land.
How to live on the land. I mean, there are many devotees who have spent decades studying how to implement farm. That's a thing that's given over. Which has not developed, at least as of today. It has not gone in that direction. Never did. Never did.
So Vanashram, in the sense of living simply, I mean, that's something we've been towards. Maybe not understand.
Well, living simply means you start changing your economic base. Again, remember that Varna is almost entirely, has to do with how you make your living. It does determine also which ashrams you go into. Like the Shudras only have the Grahastha ashram, the Vaishyas have only the Brahmachari Grahastha, the Kshatriyas have Brahmachari Grahastha, Vanaprastha, and only the Brahmanas take something else. So it does have some effect on the ashrams, but mostly the Varna applies to how you make your living. So certainly if we're going to establish the Varnas, we have to change the economic base. I mean, we're having a hard time in ISKCON establishing the ashrams. We talked about this a little bit last week. We really have a hard time with that. We have a lot of confusion. We have people who are externally in the Brahmachari, Brahmachari, Vanaprastha, Sannyas ashram, who try to subtly take the pleasures of the Grahastha ashram by amassing a lot of wealth, by having a lot of adulation with the opposite sex, by having some kind of at least emotional relationship with the opposite sex. And then we have people in the Grahastha ashram who try to imitate the renunciates. It's quite common. Both of those things are quite common. So we haven't even... And then because we're pulling in from the society in general, you know, I was saying last week how the idea of ashram, if you're going to marry, you should do it before you're 24. No, we're not doing something like that. And when people are marrying at 34 or 44, when people are marrying at 54, then how are you going to take vanaprastha and sannyas? You know, you're having a child when you're 45 or 50. So then but this is because we're bringing in from the outside society. The people are already confused. You know, we have people from the outside society. They're 35. They're not married. They have a job. They have their own house. So that's a mix. If you have a house and you have money and a job, you're a grahastha, but there's no husband or wife there, no children. So that's, again, you're trying to get the pleasures of the grahastha ashram and the pleasures of a renounced ashram. But what to do? This is the situation that it is. So we're having trouble even instituting the ashrams. You're not going to say to somebody who's 45 years old and single and at a job with a home, of course we used to say this sort of thing, you have to move into the ashram and become a brahmachari or a brahmachari. We used to preach like that. Nor are we going to say, okay, well, you're living like a grahastha, now you've got to find a spouse at 45. So then they end up tottering between the ashrams. But what to speak of the varnas? We have a problem instituting the varnas in ISKCON because nobody wants to say they're a shudra. So it's tough. I don't have a simple answer. But I do know that because the varnas deal with economics, if we get the economics down, that will help. At least we'll start having a model. At least we should try to think for ourselves, what is my varna, and then get my economic subsistence in that way, in one of those categories. And then there are certain rules. There's rules for, it's again, the pleasure and responsibility. There's rules, this is how you can earn your living, and then you have certain responsibilities that go along with that rule. So you can earn your living by taxing, but then you have to distribute the wealth. You can earn a living by trade or by cow protection or by farming, but then you have to distribute the excess and you have to have respect for the land and the cows. At least we should try to get the principles down. Shri Prahlad, would you have something else you want to say?
I have a comment. I'm appreciating the way you're explaining it.
goes, that Varnashram means everybody has to be Vaishya. That's interesting. No, one thing, one, I mean, you're saying, Pranabhu, it's very difficult to understand our nature. I mean, it's a fact. I know, looking at myself, I'm mixed caste of unknown origins, too. I've got a little of this and a little of that, a little of this and a little of that, you know. Shivaram Maharaj told me, he said, I have something from all the Varnas. He said, I've been a Shudra, a Vaishya, etc., and a Brahma. You know, so, and I see in myself, I don't have much Vaishya tendencies, but I've only got Brahman, Satri, and Shudra tendencies. So we have this mix, but I think we have to decide. make a decision. And you know something, my dear friends? We're not this body. This life is very short. Gurujan Prabhu says it's 8 billionths of a second of universal time. It really doesn't matter so much. You know, you don't have to have this, I'm a Brahman, or I'm a this. It doesn't matter. Just find something where you're I was explaining this to one devotee the other day, and I heard from somebody else, unrelated, I didn't even bring it up, that Prabhupada had said it, though I haven't found it, that one way you can tell what is your varna is that which gives you energy. What kind of work gives you energy? What kind of work do you feel? You feel like you're in the right place. So what is the main kind of work that energizes you, and that should be the way you earn your livelihood. So the brahmanas are, of course, given 6 kinds of livelihood. They can study. Now, even in modern society, some people are maintained just for studying. That's all they do is study. You know that? Some people are just researchers. They just research. Maybe they write papers. They don't even teach. So one occupation is to be a student. We don't have that in ISKCON. In ISKCON, we don't maintain very many scholars. Handful in the whole society are maintained just for studying. Another brahminical occupation is to teach. Of course, you can do more than one. Another is to worship the deity. And someone is worshiping the deity and they're maintained. Another is to teach others to worship the deity, to accept charity, and to give in charity. Now, to accept charity means that's all you're doing. You're just accepting charity. All the other occupations of a Brahmin, for all the occupations of a Brahmin, ideally, one should not get a salary. The problem with a salary is that you come to depend on having a certain amount of money every month. You therefore develop a lifestyle that is dependent on getting that income every month. And therefore, you can be controlled. If somebody says, I'm not going to give you that amount this month, all of a sudden you're in trouble because you can't pay your bills. So the ideal Brahmin should put themselves in a situation where, if necessary, they can live on nothing. And then they can't be manipulated by anybody. As soon as the Brahmin can be manipulated by money, they lose their ability to speak the truth, they lose their ability to guide the society, and then opulence becomes a source of degradation. So, of course, there are other subsidiary occupations that some Brahmins can take. You can be an astrologer, you can be a physician, there's a few other things. But in all those cases, you're supposed to subsist on whatever people give you voluntarily. Which means you have to have the kind of lifestyle. And this is very difficult for a grihastha Brahmin to do this. But you're supposed to have the kind of lifestyle where, again, if you get something, you can live, and if you don't get something, you can live. Prabhupada talks about this Brahmana who lived under a tamarind tree, and his wife would bake rice, and he lived on rice and tamarind. Of course, again, this is a very difficult thing to do in modern society. The government doesn't let you just build a hut under a tree somewhere. You know, you have to get a house, and the house has to meet the government codes, and the government taxes the brahmanas. The government doesn't say to you, oh, very nice, you're a teacher in the Hare Krishna school, we won't tax you. So it's very, very difficult. But as far as possible, the brahmana should be in that position where they're giving these things, whatever they get, they get. So the benefits of being a brahmana is you're your own boss. You're not anybody else's subservient. You can choose what you want to do within those brahminical occupations, and the cost is that you don't know what you're going to get from one day to the next. By the way, this is one reason why people of like caste should marry. Actually, just reading the 7th canto of Prabhupada says intermarriage is sinful. Anyway, one reason why people of like caste should marry is because you've not only got to have a Brahmin man, but a Brahmin woman to live like that. A Vaishya woman is not going to want to live like that. She's going to say, we need a regular income, my dear. What kind of a life is this? One month you get $5,000, the next month you only get $200. I can't live like this. How am I supposed to budget? You know, I just, so there's got to be some compatibility there. Then Kshatriyas are somebody who lives, as Prabhupada talks about, landlord, or, by the way, Kshatriya doesn't mean a business manager, because Prabhupada often uses the word administrator, but he means a government administrator. So somebody who's a mayor, governor, president, or landlord. Basically, you own property, and people are paying you taxes for the use of that property, then just like the landlord is supposed to redistribute part of the wealth to take care of the tenants. And somebody in that position also has to be willing to fight. They have to provide security for the people that they're taking care of. And a kshatriya is allowed to live very opulently. That's one of the pleasures for a kshatriya. But the sacrifice they have to make is if there's a fight, they've got to be right at the front line. And that means not just a physical fight with bows and arrows and spears, but that means criticism also. Everybody criticizes the political leaders. That's, you know, one of the sports of the citizenry. Who can shoot arrows at the heart of the political leaders? And they've got to be very powerful. Then the Vaishyas is somebody, there's many occupations for Vaishyas. I think they're listed in the conversation between Krishna and Nanda Maharaj. Probably some other cases in regard to the Indra Jagya. So you can take care of cows, you can be basically a dairyman, or you can grow crops, you can engage in banking, you can engage in trade, any kind of business. So also the Vaishyas are allowed to become opulent. Some Vaishyas will just engage in subsistence farming and not engage, you know, have much in trade. Prabhupada talks about that. But the Vaishyas can also accumulate great wealth, which then they distribute throughout the society. And the pleasures they can have, of course, they're living in accord with the land and with the animals. And again, they can have great opulence. And the sacrifices, as Prabhupada said, they have to be honest. They can't work on the black market. And then they have to give. And the Shudras is basically anybody who's in a subordinate position but doing an honest livelihood. So all of the labor, entertainers. And frankly, many of us in this age have a very Shudra mentality. And the Shudra sacrifice is they have to be willing to live without being honored in society. Just like, you know, we have a big festival, and generally some people get honored and some people never get honored. Right? We're talking about how in the school the secretary doesn't usually get honored, the bus driver, without which the school couldn't function. But people are, you know, they're always praising the teachers and the principals. So if someone's in a support position, they have to be willing to live without honor. I don't know, I've never been in a temple where they glorify the bathroom cleaners. Never happened. They'll glorify the cooks. I've never heard them glorify the bathroom cleaners, never heard them glorify the pot washers. I really noticed this when I switched from being a book distributor to a mother. You know, when I was a book distributor, it was like, Armila distributed 600 Bhaktigatans! Here's your maha plate, here's your garland, and then it was, nobody ever said, Armila changed 4 poopy nappies today! It hasn't happened yet, I'm still waiting, you know, for that one. So that when you do sutra work, you don't get glorified. You know, you're taken for granted. You just have to go on with your service, and you have to be very honest. Right? And the Shudras, in traditional Vedic times, the Shudras were paid in kind. They were not paid much in cash. One has to be willing to be on the direction of the higher castes. And then there are different degrees of Shudras. Some Shudras work directly for a master, and some are more independent. But, you know, just like I'm engaging artists for my books, and they'll sometimes have really nice ideas. And, oh, I want to do it this way and that way. And I'll say, I don't like it that way. Well, too bad for them. They can't do it the way they want. They have to do it the way I want. Why? I'm paying them. You know. They say, well, I really wanted it this way, but okay. You know, of course, then there's another, a higher level. It's the Shudra, they're just doing their own paintings, and they distribute them. Selling them, whoever wants to buy them can buy them. They're not working for a particular master. So there's also different levels of Shudras. But it's bad, just, you know, what is it that gives you energy and makes you happy? And then take that honestly and pay the proper sacrifice for it and dedicate it to Krishna. Krishna says everybody can become perfect by doing their work. And that would be one of the main ways of starting, is with economics. The other way is, at least, we're not doing this either, but at least those people who grow up in the Hare Krishna movement should be trained to be properly in the ashrams. That would be nice. Even that's not happening. Our children are, to a large extent, following the pattern, understandably, of the adults, and who are following the pattern of the outside society. So that's. But those are the places where I see we can go into it. With our occupation and just training the youth properly in the principles of ashram. At least train them in the principles. At least train them in the ideas. So at least there's some hope. You know, maybe our great-great-grandchildren will be properly situated in the ashrams. But it's hard because the outside society is going down. And we're pulling in people. We want to be pulling in people from the outside society. So we're constantly pulling in bad examples. Constantly. Which we then have to make as part of our own social norms. We have to. We're not going to socially stigmatize people who come in from the outside in some weird ashram situation that's already like that. We're just not going to do it. First of all, nobody would join. And second of all, that wouldn't be very fair. Do you follow what I'm saying? Anything else? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.